Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Do you like what you're hearing right now? Then be sure to check out VOC Nation. Whether it's on VOCNation.com or your favorite podcast provider, VOC Nation offers the greatest in live and on-demand content, great interviews, and incredible insight from those who have lived the business. 7 days a week, VOCNation.com. And don't forget to check us out on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Welcome to another edition of Bumps and Thumps, the talk of wrestling. I'm Brian Ferguson. Today, my guest, returning guest, frequent flyer, whatever you want to call him. He is the historian, as we like to call him, the world's most dangerous pro wrestling historian. I want to welcome back Mr. George Shire. Here we go. George, how we doing?
Guten Morgen. Oh, I'm doing good. It's great to be doing a show that we're not going to talk about a passing of one of our family members here. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Ole Anderson tribute that we had with Lars Anderson, Larry Hyneme. Yes. We've got good words. We got good comments from it. And just special kudos to Larry for taking time out to do it. That was fun. But today, we're going to have some fun and just kind of low key and talk about some special things about, and I'm going to talk about the AWA today.
Yeah. Well, our subject today is going to be on feuds, which is an integral part of the business. You got to have a good guy, bad guy, duking it out, if you will, or teams or fashions, whatever you want to call it, to be successful. And so we're going to talk about some big ones here today. Some well, hopefully well-known ones, particularly in the AWA. You know, the AWA is near and dear to your heart and mine. You know, it's a special place, you know. A different era for you than me, but however, I would consider what you were in was the golden era. You know, the 60s, 70s. I was more of the late 70s into the 80s guy.
But saw a lot.
I did see a lot. And well, I want to talk about that. So I want kind of your perspective on feuds, kind of what it means to the business, George, and some of your more well-known ones to you that really stick out in your mind, if you would.
Well, you know, Brian, I think you put it really nicely when you said that feuds are kind of what makes a territory go. You mentioned the good guy and the bad guy. I don't think we'd have to convince anyone of modern day wrestling that if you were to look back at the old days, what I call the old days, the 60s, the 70s, the very early 80s, it was more defined. It was very easy to tell the good guy and the bad guy. You know, that old white hat, black hat perspective. And the fans could determine right away who they were going to boo and who they were going to cheer. And we know that, you know, in today's wrestling, today's world, that's clouded today.
Mm-hmm.
Just in society as a general, it's crowded. Who's good and who's bad? It's no longer white hat, black hat. Sometimes they're down the middle. Sometimes they're both bad. It's a more complicated thing, and wrestling is that way too. But
Yeah.
man, I tell you what, in my era, in this AWA, boy, the wrestling territories, they had to present an episodic soap opera ongoing wrestling story each week. Some of them promoted weekly, and the AWA did promote weekly and then bi-weekly in the 60s into the early 70s. So in a particular town, you would have a weekly show or an every other week show. And it's tough, when you're doing that, because you have to hopefully draw the fans in. And I always go back to what Vern Gagne told me many years ago. He said, we do a TV show, we have the wrestlers do their thing, we encourage them, Marty's out there, run, don't walk, get your tickets. And he said, once we get them in their seats at the arena, then we have to give all of those fans a reason to want to come back. And one of the things that I always find interesting about fans, they'll say, well, they had these screw job finishes, and they didn't give the fans what they wanted. They wanted so and so to win, and they had him get disqualified, or they had some goofy, they viewed the tapes and the title wasn't changed. And those fans don't realize that those were the things that pulled those fans back in. And I look at the, I say, I'm being facetious, but the 700 times I saw Nick Bockwinkel wrestle Billy Robinson, I saw them in singles matches. I want to say about maybe 75 to 100 times, different matches, and then they battled in tag bouts too. But those singles matches, and what the fans, every fan that left the arena on any one of those matches, they left believing that Billy was the better guy. They left the ring, or they left the arena frustrated that Nick Bockwinkel, tossed him over the top rope, or Bobby Heenan interfered, or the referee didn't see the foreign object, or didn't see, he was knocked out when Billy had the 20 count on Nick, and nobody, the ref wasn't there. The fans don't realize that that was what wanted you to, man, you were frustrated. Billy should have won. Billy should have been the champ. And if he's going to get another shot, they're going to buy another ticket. That's what it was all about. And that was the beauty of it. And so the fans that don't understand that, they're right to be frustrated. I mean, that's what it was meant to do. But it was done so beautifully. So in our eyes, Billy Robinson around the horn, everybody you talk to, well, Billy should have had a run with the title. And as long as they believe that, the wrestlers did their jobs.
I can tell you, quite honestly, Nick Bockwinkel to me was probably, no, he was the greatest heel champion
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
ever. I mean, you talk about him and Billy Robinson, him and Vern Gagne had such a feud, such a believable hatred for one another that, my mind, I believe Ric Flair modeled himself as far as his tactics in the ring with the 1-2, and then he puts his foot on the bottom rope on the
Yeah.
third count. That was Nick Bockwinkel.
Yeah.
He did that way before Flair did. Little things that Flair did just reminds me of what Bockwinkel did before Flair. His sarcasm, his arrogance, his and he could just he just poke a little bit at somebody and they get so frustrated. Gagne, Robinson, the Heenan family, that's a feud right there. The Heenan family, when they were in the ring with Crippler and Bockwinkel, when they were tag team champions, they just the high flyers when they had those little feuds. And you talk about the good and the bad guy. When you said the hat, it reminded me of Black Jack Lanza.
Yeah.
Lanza, when he was a bad guy, wore the black hat, and when he was a good guy, he wore the white hat. Very distinctive.
Well, and you know, that's probably moving way ahead in the timeline for the AWA, because that was in the
Right, but
80s.
I'm just saying, yeah.
I'll tell you something. My wife still loves that moment. She was at me or at with the card with me the
Yeah.
night that when Jack Lanza was going to go against Bobby Heenan in a bunkhouse match, because he'd split with Bobby Heenan, and he
Yeah.
came to the arena. There was no advance announcement of this, and he came to the ring. He had a big white cowboy hat on with a feather on it. He had the white vest. He had the white glove, because he always wore a black glove on his
Yep.
hand. He had the
Yep.
white glove. He had white trunks, and he had white cowboy boots. And when he come out, I swear to God, the pop that he
Yeah.
got, and Bobby Heenan was throwing a fit in the ring. But that night, it was defined perfectly that I'm through with you, Bobby Heenan, and I am going to beat you in this match. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
That was
Yeah.
beautiful. And you know, Brian, you touched on it with Nick and Ric Flair. That's a good analogy, because all of these wrestlers, every one of them took something from their opponents. They took something from their peers. They took different styles and they fitted into their repertoire to make them who they were. And when you see, now I saw Nick Bockwinkel in the earlier years before Ric Flair came around. And I
Right.
can tell you that there were many mannerisms, many things that Nick was doing as a heel, because he had come here after, boy, 15 years of being a relatively a baby face in all the territories he was in. So this heel thing was new to him when he had a year in Atlanta as a heel before he came to Vern's territory in December of 70, but to start his heel run. But I saw immediately in Nick Bockwinkel a lot of Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
There
And
you go.
I tell anyone, go to YouTube,
Yeah.
look at some Buddy Rogers title
Yeah.
matches, or if there's clips out there, the strut,
Yeah.
the arrogance.
Yeah.
Buddy had it down. And yeah, Nick took some of his, but then Nick had so much he was able to absorb. There are some wrestlers that can just absorb the people around them.
Yeah.
And with that, I will tell you that that was one of the beauties of, again, the many territories that existed,
Yeah.
because these guys could go to a different territory and have 15 or 20 new guys to work with, work against, team with, watch.
Yeah.
Nick was a student of wrestling. He would actually step outside the locker room and watch a particular wrestler or match. And they did this because not only when they're in the ring with them or when they're teaming with them, but they're learning from them. And then they pick out things that'll work for them. And there are some things they can't copy. You know, sometimes a certain wrestler can't pull it off.
Yeah.
So that was a very good analogy that you made
Yeah.
with Ric Flair, because Ric came through Vern's camp. And Rick had his first year and a half here in the AWA. You go back and you look at the old 60s or early 70s results, and Rick was losing to people, you know,
Yeah.
on the card, but he was being trained. And you remember the other day when we were talking to Larry Hyneme, and we were talking about Ole and about Larry teaming with Gene Anderson, becoming the Wrecking Crew. And I
Yep.
had mentioned to Larry that many times during his first year in the business, on more often than not on a card, it was Larry Hyneme versus Gene Anderson. And those were training matches. And Larry
Yeah.
admitted that. No, we were we, he was training me. You
Yeah.
know, that was part of it. He was
Yeah.
teaching Larry Hyneme. And that's how these
Yeah.
wrestlers do.
Yeah. I want to talk about a tag team feud that I thought from the 60s. I hope I'm not jumping ahead of you, but I want to
Oh,
talk
go ahead.
about Larry Henning, Harley Race versus Crusher and Bruiser. Now that was a feud. I wasn't around then, but I've watched, like you said, the YouTube videos, some of the promos they did, calling them the Dollies. Talk to us about that, George. What was that like? That your emotions, your as a fan going in there, like. Talk to us about that, if you would.
Well, the thing you have to also realize about pro wrestling, and Vern Gagne, regardless of what people saw of him in the last 5 years of the business of the company in the 80s, if you go back to the 60s, his territory, he knew how better than anyone else at the time. And he had Wally Carbo with him. And they knew how to start a program between two guys or two tag teams and make it so that it's going to draw money. And of course you got to have the right talent. Mm-hmm. When you always have to start with a slow burn. The feud just doesn't start. Let's just put you guys in the ring and let them work. I mean, rarely that could work and right. involve into something else. But generally you had to move it along with baby steps. So in the Hennigan Race Crusher Bruiser thing that you mentioned, first of all, you had Larry Hennig, who had been turning a heel for about a year before he hooked up with Harley Race. We had seen Larry evolve from the trainee from Vern Gagne in the early years of the 60s and becoming more aggressive because he was a bigger dude. He wasn't a Gagne-built type guy physically. And Vern Gagne's style was never going to fit Larry Hennig. It's just, that was it. And so you had the natural there for the starters where Larry would turn on his trainer because I'm better than he is. He's older, I'm younger, and I'm going to beat him. So that was a natural. But by the time we got to Harley Race.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Harley was 21 years old. And you think about this. In 1964, Harley Race comes in here. Larry, by his own admission, he talked to me, and he also wrote this in my book, one of the AWA results books. He said that he went to Wally Carbo and Vern, and he said, give me that kid, Harley. Now, he had seen Harley in Amarillo when Harley had went down there, and Larry had went down there, and he was working as a heel a little bit down there in 63 into the early part of 64. And he had met Harley, but he said, give me Harley. Let me work with him. I like this kid. That was an experiment because Harley was 21 years old. Larry at the time was, I think there was about a 5 year, 6 year difference in their age. So Larry was, 25, 26, seven, whatever he was. And they have this team, but they worked it out so well because it was a slow build with Larry and Harley that they were going to team up. And they would come out and boast. And right away, he was, I'm no longer just Larry Hennig. I'm Pretty Boy Larry Hennig. And he comes in with handsome Harley Race. Well, as simple as that little gimmick is, you think about it when you're watching on TV and you got these two prima donnas on there talking about how pretty they are. I'm handsome. And Harley, he was honing his interview skills, but he was so good when he'd come out and he'd look at Marty O'Neill and he'd say, they're going to build a monument. We're going to be the greatest tag team in the history of wrestling. And it's going to be handsome Harley Race and Pretty Boy Larry Hennig. And they would insult the fans. You know, you ladies out there watching, you know that you're looking at our bodies and all you've got sitting next to you is that big fat guy eating potato chips with a beer in his hand. And, you know, does that, and it's so simple, but it works. And so we have 4 months, October of 64 to December of the year. Hennigan Race, they give them a decent push. They're beating little baby face teams here and there. They ended up in a feud with Vern Gagne, Reggie Parks.
Yeah.
And Vern wasn't a champion at that time. He was just kind of working some tag bouts with Reggie Parks. And they have this three-card battle. Well, what happens is during the course of this 3 months or 4 months, Hennigan Race are saying they want a shot at the tag team championship. They want to be the tag team champions. The problem was, and this was behind-the-scenes promotional teasing the fans,
yeah.
The promoters would come out, Wally Carbo. He'd come out and say, well, we don't know where the Crusher is, you know, because Crusher lost a loser leave the AWA match to Vern back in August or October of 64. Mm-hmm. So he was nowhere to be found, but he held half of the title with the Bruiser. So Hennigan Race are always saying, we want to wrestle him and we're going to beat him. But remember, Crusher and Bruiser were heels.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the beauty of it is they get in this feud, Hennigan Race, they get in this feud with Parks and Gagne. And in the third match of their series of matches, Wilbur Snyder was on the card. And Wilbur Snyder came out during their tag team match. And he was basically going to second or just watch Gagne and Parks. And it was well known that Wilbur and Vern were longtime buddies.
Yep.
So there's Wilbur Snyder. Well, during the course of the match, Hennigan Race are doing their usual behind the referee's back, every illegal thing they could do. And Wilbur Snyder got up to the ring and started pointing to the referee that he did, you know, Harley did this or that. Before you know it, Wilbur got into it, and Hennigan Race actually lost the match by disqualification. They were upset. They figured Snyder put his nose into their business. And they boasted, if he wants to put his nose in our business, get a partner. Why doesn't he join Gagne and Parks and we'll take him on? We'll find a partner. And they tease the fans.
Yeah.
None of your business who our partner's going to be. So I went on for 2 weeks. All of a sudden, they're boasting and they're bragging. We pulled a coup. We have the greatest partner in the world, one half of the world tag team champions, Dick the Bruiser. Now you tell us who's got the better team, Gagne, Parks, and Snyder. That's their buildup. During the course of that match, Hennigan Race. And I was there. I got the program, and God, that's one of my most vivid memories.
Yeah.
Hennigan Race would tag in and tag out, and they wouldn't tag to the Bruiser. And the Bruiser's prancing on the side of the ring, holding the tag rope. Every time he tried to get in, you know, the referee would get him out because he can't come in illegally. And he's prancing, and they are, Hennigan Race are back and forth in the ring. This went on for the first two falls. And in the third fall, so that the teams had split a fall. And in the third fall, Bruiser had enough. He comes into the ring, pushes the referee, takes Hennig, takes Race by the hair, and slams their heads together. Larry Hennig goes flipping out of the ring onto the floor. Harley Race gets pinned 1, 2, 3 by the Gagne Park Snyder team. And the Bruiser leaves the ring, just walks off. Oh my God. You talk about heat. Okay.
Yeah.
So the following week on TV, Hennigan Race, they sold it so well. And they were so good. That Benedict, and this is all what they did, that Benedict Arnold, that Judas, we gave him the opportunity to team with the greatest tag team in the world, and he stabbed us in the back. We want him. We want him in a match. And Carbo comes out. Well, I don't know where the Crusher is. Then Bruiser comes out. And, you know, in typical Bruiser gruff voice, yeah, you know, nobody can imitate it. But he says, I don't know where the Crusher is, but I'm going to go to Milwaukee and I'm going to go through every saloon, every bar, and I'm going to find the Crusher. The fans are just rabid for this.
Yeah.
We get to January 15th, of 1965 in like one of the first cards of the year, and the Bruiser found the Crusher, and they're going to meet. They're going to put the title on the line. And their interviews, we're going to end these Dolly sisters, these prima donnas, you know. And you got to bear in mind that at this point in time, Crusher and Bruiser technically are still heels, because Crusher left. When Crusher left after losing to Vern in the Loser Leave Town or Loser Leave AWA, that was at the height of the Crusher's heel days. He was so over as a heel. And he had lost to Vern, who he had been feuding with, and he left. And they claimed they didn't know where he was for 4 months. So in that match, you technically had two heel tag teams.
Yeah.
And of course, they made it a big deal. We've got four of the toughest guys in the business. We need a special referee. So Stanley Blackburn has ordered Tiny Mills, King of the Lumberjacks, to come out and be the special referee. Now, Tiny was in his getting close to retirement of his own pro career at this time.
Right.
The guy was 6 foot six or 6 foot four or five legit. And he was the King of the Lumberjacks. So he was going to be the man to, you know, hold court to keep law and order. Well, we get during the match, Tiny gets bumped by I forget who it was that bumped him. He fell out of the ring. Supposedly he hit his back on the ring as he went out. He's laying on the floor. He can't continue. The announcer gets on. We need a referee out here. These four guys are, you know, battling it out. Wally Carbo comes out right on the microphone in the auditorium, and he says, none of the referees on the card want to come out here and get in the ring with these four guys. And then all of a sudden the fans start cheering. You hear the cheers get louder as this individual comes to the ring. Well, it's Vern Gagne. He's got his sport coat on, his street clothes, and he gets in the ring and he says, Wally can't get any of these referees, so I'm just going to referee the match. Now you got Vern Gagne. And it was so beautiful because there are so many stories being told within this whole thing that I've just told you.
Yeah.
Hennig is protesting beyond belief. He doesn't want Vern Gagne as the referee. He's in the middle ring. Carbo's in there. I'm not going to have him be the referee. He hates Vern Gagne. Vern Gagne won't be fair to him. And of course, the Crusher, he was protesting. I don't want Vern Gagne. I'm not going to wrestle, you know. And Carbo says, you're both going to wrestle. You're going to go, or we're going to suspend you all, you know, the whole thing. So the match goes on. During the match, it's so beautiful. Hennig and Vern get into a couple pushing matches. And at one time, the Crusher and Vern got into a couple of pushing matches. So they haven't officially made Crusher and Bruiser babies or anything. But then after Vern had had enough of Larry, he popped him. Larry went down. They got beat. Hennig and Race got beat. And the Crusher and the Bruiser left. And, of course, now they want a rematch. Well, by this time, now Crusher and Bruiser are good guys. In between the next tag team match between them, they had a match between Vern and Hennig as a main event on one of the cards. And, you know, Hennig's going to get revenge for what he did in the match. But 2 weeks later, on January 31st, Hennig and Race won the title from Crusher and Bruiser. But that bona fide Crusher is a good guy. Bruiser was in and out. He had his own territory. Fans that don't know, he was running the World Wrestling Association in Indianapolis. And he was going to be gone. But Crusher started teaming with other wrestlers. And the feud with him and Hennig and Race in July of 65, Bruiser wasn't available. So he said, I'm going to pull my own surprise. And Crusher comes out and brings Vern Gagne. And, of course, you've got the beauty in the story. How can Vern and how can Crusher coexist? Because just a year ago, they were involved in a multi-month battle. That is how you told the story. And, of course, every time the Bruiser would come to town, Crusher, they had many matches. If you look at results, Hennig and Race met Bruiser and Crusher probably more than any other team. And it was a match that in any AWA city, they could draw a huge crowd or a sellout.
Yeah.
The Crusher and the Bruiser. And they did exchange the title back with them in 66 for a little bit. Crusher and Bruiser got it back for a while. And the reason they did was Hennigan Race were taking a tour of Australia. And when they went down there, Hennigan Race came in as international, the very first international tag team champions in Australia. We didn't know that here. But when they came back, they got their title back from Crusher and Bruiser. But that feud you talk about, that was money. And the Crusher, of course, now had become our number one go-to baby face. And the thing was, in those days, in the 60s, up until the very early 70s, Crusher still wrestled as rough and tough and mean and ornery as he did when he was a heel. But now he was battling the good guys. And one of his top feuds was in 65 and 66 was Mad Dog Vachon was the world champion in 64 and 65. He had taken Vern's title in 64. And so Crusher and Mad Dog had a long battle for that year and a half, 2 years. Crusher even took the title from him for a little bit, coffee break type thing to build rematches. Mm-hmm. Dog got it back. And their battles, now you talk about transitioning into another moneymaker feud. Oh, my God. Crusher versus Mad Dog in the 60s. That went around the horn. And I would venture to say it was probably the top singles feud for the AWA. And they climaxed it in the cities with cage matches. And, of course, Vern had then won the title back from the Dog February of 67, and Crusher and Mad Dog could still have their battles. And then the Vachon brothers came in 68, Crusher and Bruiser against them. But it was so beautifully done. And if you name one feud, Crusher versus Mad Dog was box office. And I'll tell you how good it was. They had done this whole thing from 65, 6, 7, 8. And then when the Crusher and the Bruiser lost the tag team title in 69, August of 69, and Crusher was gone, it was reported that he had been injured in the tag team match, and they had a back injury. They didn't know when he was going to be back. Now, I always tell this to fans because the Crusher, if you want to name one guy through the 60s as a heel and then a baby and then through the 70s, you want to name one guy that could always draw extra fans to the auditorium other than Vern. Every time Vern was on the marquee, the attendance was up. People that don't believe that, look at the attendance records. I can prove it. But right. Crusher, he was box office. So Crusher would take these, what I call self-imposed vacations. After that August of 69 battle, he was injured, according to what we were told, and in wrestling. But he was home resting or taking it easy. He didn't wrestle for 3, 4, 5 months. This was in August. Well, January of 70 comes along. The Vachons are still champions, and they're running roughshod over other tag teams. And who comes back into the TV studio? And this is the one match fans can look at on YouTube. It's the famous one where the Crusher comes out while the Vachons are wrestling a TV match against Bruce Kirk and...
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Edward Carpentier on a TV match.
Wow. Okay.
And during the course of the match, Carpentier is injured. And Bruce Kirk is going to have to go and wrestle alone. Well, out behind the curtain in his street clothes comes the Crusher. And he is going to try to be Bruce Kirk's partner. All hell breaks loose. Bruiser and Dog get into it. On the video, you can see it. Crusher hits his head on the table. Mad Dog, bleeds, comes into the ring. The blood is squirting out. Crusher strangling him. It's on YouTube. It's one of the most famous ones. But that started that Crusher Mad Dog feud all over again. And from that January 70 into April, May of 70, they again wrestled all around the horn, climaxed with cage matches. Now you've a decade of, I mean, 5, 6, 7 years apart, you're still be able to draw with that same feud. That tells you how powerful it was. And each of them with various partners. Of course, Mad Dog with Butcher most of the time. But Crusher with Byrne, he teamed with Carpentier. He had Bruiser back in. I mean, that's how you build a feud.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. Yeah, those guys could always draw so well. I want to go fast forward a little bit. Sheik's Army.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, they had quite a feud with the High Flyers. They had a lot of feuds, but the one I remember in particular, you know, with the High Flyers and then, you know, with Gagne, Verne. Talk about that a little. How did that kind of build up, that feud, the High Flyers versus the Sheiks?
Well, you have to realize, first of all, that one of the age-old gimmicks that we're not able to get away with today in our world, we live in a politically correct world, very sensitive world. You and I both know that there are times that you don't dare say good morning to someone because you might have offended them. You know, we can't compliment someone because there might be an innuendo in there. You know, hey, that's a nice tie. You know, you tell a lady, oh, you got your hair cut. It looks cute. Well, you've just, you know, you might be a sexual. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. So today we live in a different world. But back then, oh, man, especially with the foreigners in wrestling. And we've talked about this. After World War II, you know, we had evil Germans, we had the hated Japanese, and we had the evil Russians. And we had, you know, any country other than the United States, they were bad guys. They were evil. So you got the Sheik. And that's one of the greatest gimmicks that Verne ever came up with. You have to remember that Adnan Casey, and some fans won't know this, but he had been in the business since about 1960. He had wrestled a lot early in his career as Adnan Casey. He was an Olympic wrestler out of Iraq, legit. And he wrestled mostly as a babyface, just Adnan Casey. There was no evil country atone to his persona. And then a lot of the times he wrestled as Billy White Wolf, a Native American, an Indian star, Billy White Wolf. And he was a good guy. It was interesting because pro wrestling never made Indians bad guys, even though if you watch Westerns on TV, it usually was the cowboys versus the Indians. But wrestling was always pretty good about that. They never had the Indians as bad guys, with probably the rarest of exception. There might be something out there that it's not common to me. So Billy White Wolf was a good guy, very popular. He was in the Pacific Northwest. He was in Texas, and he was in the WWF at the time as Billy White Wolf all along the way. Verne wanted to bring him in 1980 into the AWA, but Verne didn't want another Indian. He had had Wahoo McDaniel. He had Billy Red Cloud. He didn't want an Indian, Native American. And Verne came up with the idea, let's go with an Iraqi Sheik. Adnan jumped on. And we don't have to even say how good he was in that evil character. Yeah. You know, he was always going to take down the Americans. The Iraqis were better. All the harems that he had and the jewels. And he bragged about his association with Saddam Hussein. You know, that was an evil time because Hussein was really our enemy at that point in time. So Verne created that. Now, the beauty of it is that at first he was just Sheik Adnan al-Casey, and he was here to take the title back to Iraq. Fans, some will remember that when Verne retired in 1981, without putting an elimination series in place, after he retired, the title just reverted back to the former champion, Nick Bockwinkel. And I will agree with you that that wasn't a popular decision with fans. You know, everybody will tell you they should have had an elimination match, or they could have had a tournament. And Blackburn says, no, no, it would take too long. We've got championship matches scheduled around the country. And so Nick, by his past record, okay. Well, the fans were unhappy. So Vern did a genius thing, and we've talked about this. He put Nick against the Sheik.
Yes.
With the Sheik saying, I'm going to take the title back to Iraq. I'm going to leave America, and you're never going to get me back on American soil. Well, for that brief time, the fans aligned themselves with Nick because he was America, regardless of who Nick Bach went. And then another genius thing was they got Bobby Heenan out of the equation, because I don't know if that would have been enough to sway Nick to be the heel versus the Sheik. I don't know. But the Sheik attacked Bobby Heenan in the match, bloodied him up. Heenan was gone. The fans were cheering for Nick was still a heel, but he was American. And I was there. We heard USA, USA, USA. Well, they had that series of matches. There were four in each city around the AWA horn. By the time that was done, the Sheik was disposed. He didn't get the title. And they had him get involved in another match with Baron von Raschke at the time. And Baron had come back to be a special referee for one of their matches with Nick. And Raschke had clobbered the Sheik and Nick pinned him or something. And, you know, that started the feud between them. And then Nick was back to defending the title to Billy Robinson and whoever, and the fans were booing him. So it was so genius the way it was handled, because it could have very easily turned into Nick being a baby, which they didn't want to do.
Right.
But now they had forgotten that Vern Gagne gave the title back to him, or he got it without wrestling for it. But there you got the Sheik, who's so mean. And then he comes up with a really good thing. He gets Jerry Blackwell. Now, we all know how good Jerry was.
Ayatollah.
Yeah. And he dubbed him with the robe and the veil or whatever the garb they wear. I know they have a name for it.
Yeah.
But he was no longer Crusher Jerry Blackwell or just Jerry Blackwell. He was Sheik Ayatollah Jerry Blackwell. Ayatollah. And Jerry, I'm giving you all the harem and the gold and you know, perfect. And then again, you got this American wrestler aligning with the Sheik. So that was the beginning of that. Well, then the Sheik got injured, had a broken arm. He had the broken arm.
Yeah.
And he had to get a partner for Ayatollah Blackwell. And he pulls off something. This is where you want to play with fans' emotions. You want to drag them into a story. He goes to Bobby Heenan. Now, even though Ken Patera was a heel in the Bobby Heenan family, he was still an American wrestler. He was an Olympic strong man. He had gold, he had gold and silver medals, legit from the Olympics. And the Sheik come in and offered to buy Ken Patera from Bobby Heenan. And this is a segment, and I think it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
He comes out with a suitcase, the Sheik, with $250,000 for Bobby Heenan to buy Ken Patera. And he has another suitcase with $250,000 that he's going to give to Patera to join him. Oh, my God. You know, Ken Patera, you're not going to do this. You're not going to turn on your country. And Patera sold it. What did the country ever do for me? I'm out here beating and getting beat, and I'm going to go and take the money. You got to take it when it's given to you. And he goes with the Sheik, and now he gets the robe, and he's Lawrence of Arabia. Ken Patera. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Bobby Heenan folds his suitcase up. He got $250,000. Now, we know all of this, whether we knew it then or now, we know it was all a work. It was just a great way to exchange, put Ken in. So now you had Patera and Blackwell as this Sheik tag team with Adnan as their manager. And they're all going to, they want to win the title and take the tag team titles back to Iraq. It was always that threat to the fans that they're going to take the title, and yeah. and Iraq is going to get it. And then that's where the Mom's Apple Pie High Flyers come in. You know, they had been a team now for off and on for about 6 years. They mm-hmm. had a break where they Brunzell had went down to Atlanta for a year, but they're the most popular tag, and they're babies. And if any, I think that was really the crowning achievement for Greg and Jim, because they were there to fight for America. And of course, they ended up losing their title. They were the champs. They lost them to Patera and Blackwell. And now you got the storylines about they're going to leave Patera's or Sheik's team, and Carbo is threatening them, and Blackburn is threatening him. You'll defend the title or we'll strip you of them. And that is the beauty of a feud. But turning against America,
yeah,
you know, turning your back on your gold medals,
yeah,
that made wrestling. That yeah. was one of the, so you picked a good one there.
Yeah, that was, that's one I, you know, I was 12, 13 years old. That was one of my fondest memories. When that, and I remember that segment on TV, which you talked about with the money. I had told Blackwell,
over a couple week period. Oh,
yeah, and it was, yeah. it was so, and it were, you know, I'm a little kid. I'm like, Ken Patera is not going to, and he did it. Even though I couldn't stand Patera because he was a heel, I was like, he's not going to do it. He's Olympian.
Yeah,
he did it, and he even perfect. Wore the man. We call it man dress and yeah. and all that. And yeah, it was that was quite a segment. When they won the titles,
we know they had a good run, Blackwell and Patera. And you know the only reason, I mean, this is a story outside of wrestling, but. The only mm-hmm. reason that they really lost the title was because Patera got into that incident in mm-hmm. Waukesha, well, Wisconsin, yeah. with the McDonald's situation. And regardless of who wants to believe how that story yeah. went down, we know that Patera was going to be serving some prison time, and Vern yeah. took the title off of them abruptly, had Crusher and Baron. He went back to the Crusher, a guy that could draw the fans.
Yeah.
Draw the fans in. And Baron had yeah. become a baby at that point. So it was mm-hmm. a natural. They were a stupid team. But, you know, well, that's my opinion, kids. But on the surface, it was a logical promotion thing. And then they lost yeah. it to the Road
Warriors. The Road Warriors. Yeah. That came later. Yeah. I tell you, this has been very interesting. Brings back a lot of memories for me, and some things I didn't know that you brought up today with the some of the heel feuds with Crusher and Bruiser. I didn't know about them being a heel team also at the same time, and now they turned. So I'm sure some fans don't know that. I mean, that might not be on YouTube either. I don't know, but
one of the things about Crusher and Bruiser is they had in the 50s they weren't cousins. They hadn't right. discovered the family relationship yet.
Right.
if you go to YouTube, there are actually some matches with Reggie Lisowski teamed with his brother Stan,
Stan.
And they had the Lisowski brothers against Dick the Bruiser and Hans Schmidt. That was two yeah. heel teams back in the 50s. Yeah. And then there's a six-man match where the Lisowskis are actually teamed with the Bruiser. But again, no, because Reggie Lisowski still had his Reggie Lisowski combed back hair, and he was a strutting blonde with his sequin yeah. jackets. I mean, he was not mm-hmm. Crusher. They actually teamed together four times in 1959. There was one that flipped over into 60 when Reggie was the Crusher, and he teamed with the Bruiser. Without looking at the results, I think one of them was in Boston. I forget where the other two or three were, but there was yeah. no connection between cousins or anything like that. There was no ongoing relationship.
Yeah.
In 1963, yeah. when the Crusher was at the height of his heel days, Vern brought in the Bruiser and teamed him with the Crusher. They were still kind of heels. Well, they were heels, and they were going to wrestle against the Kelmikoff brothers, who were the tag team champions at the time. Gosh. And Carol Kelmikoff was going to be leaving. He was going to head south for a little bit, mid-south. So they were going to lose. So in their very first match in August of 63, the Crusher and the Bruiser won the tag team title. And it was announced in the program that they now were cousins, that Crusher brought in his cousin, Dick the Bruiser. And they looked alike. They both had crew cuts the time, and they were built similar. So they were cousins. So Vern created the cousin gift.
Yeah. One more thing I want to talk about before we go. And this is a feud that I did some research on and didn't realize how much it impacted the business. That is Vern Gagne versus Hans Schmidt. That feud, they had quite a battle in the days. This is before the AWA. This is, you know, pre-AWA. Yeah. A little bit in the AWA, but mostly in when it was still dominantly, NWA. Talk to us about that a little bit, if you could.
Yeah. Well, most of their program or feud between one another was during the 50s. And we always go back to, you know, as of when the 50s, the early 50s, wrestling was influenced so much by television that every town had a local station that would air their wrestling. But the one thing that was popular back then was the Dumont Network, which was a national hookup out of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they were able to showcase five or six, seven guys that really became literally household names.
Yeah.
Vern Gagne. We've talked about Gorgeous George in the past. Killer Kowalski. Blodic Killer Kowalski, the one that took Yukon Eric's ear off. That was famous. Buddy Rogers, Lou Thesz, and Hans Schmidt. Now, that they were a lot of that stablemate for the 50s that wherever they went in, whatever town, and Vern and all these guys traveled a lot in those days. You know, they were in Boston one night, in Canada, Montreal the next, and then they'd be down in Oklahoma and so on. But one of the greatest battles that Vern had during that time was the one you touch on with the hated German Hans Schmidt. Now, you have to bear in mind that in the 50s, from the early 50s through the 50s, remember World War II. America had been at war with the Japanese and the Germans. The Germans were our enemies. And Hans Schmidt, this was a guy who had been in the business for a while by the name of Guy LaRose. He was a French Canadian. And as Guy LaRose, you know, he wasn't really going anywhere. So he shaves his head, comes up with this goose stomping German gimmick. Hated German Hans Schmidt. And he and Vern, then it was a natural because Vern at that point in time, and again, it goes back to what we started our program with today. You had that definition. Vern was the good guy. He was mom's apple pie goodbye. And then you had Hans Schmidt, who was as evil as they come. German accent, from Germany, wants to stomp on American wrestlers. And it became a natural feud that worked around the country. One of the things I found interesting was Vern and him had a lot of matches against one another. Mm-hmm. And Vern actually told me, I actually had a picture taken with him and was talking to him at the Waterloo Hall of Fame. And he was talking to me about his favorite opponent, but his least favorite opponent, he said. And when he said, I thought he was going to mention Mad Dog or somebody like that. And he said, it was Hans Schmidt. He said, every time I was in the ring with Hans, it was real. He said, he used to stomp me with those boots. And he said, they would hurt. He says, I came home more often with bruised ribs and, you know, and their feud was believable. But it was believable because, again, you had that good guy, bad guy, solid definition, America versus German. And you couldn't be a good guy German in those days.
No.
And fans wouldn't have bought you. You know, Baron von Raschke would have not been able to make the transition in those days. It would have been maybe creatively somehow they could have pulled it off. I don't know.
Nah.
But it just was America. Everybody was USA, USA.
Yeah.
For the decade of the 50s into the 60s. And so anytime you had those Japanese, I tell people all the time, the program said dirty Japs. You couldn't say that today because, you know, it's politically incorrect. But the Japs, the Germans, the Russians, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That was box office. So that was one of the favorite feuds. And there might be a clip on YouTube. There is,
but when I was doing some research about it, it was just amazing. And Hans Schmidt knocked out Vern's four front teeth for real.
Yeah.
And so he had to wear these indentations in his for the rest of his life. And it's just, like I said, I was doing some research and stuff, and I just found that I didn't know about Hans Schmidt. I had no clue.
Well, Hans Schmidt never, ever transitioned into a good guy into the 70s and into the very early 80s. He was still a goose stomping, evil, take over America, Germans better than you are, bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, another one that works so well, and you talk, and sometimes reality creates, or an accident creates a beautiful feud.
Mm-hmm.
Killer Kowalski, during the Dumont years in the 50s, he was the typical bad guy. He was Polish.
Mm-hmm.
His first name was always pronounced Wladek, Killer Kowalski. But he wasn't Killer in those days. He was just, he wrestled sometimes as Tarzan Kowalski.
Yeah.
And he gets into this battle with Yukon Eric. Now, Yukon Eric was obviously the good guy. He had the blue jeans on. He was, you know, he's from Alaska, good guy. Everybody wanted to see him win. His big thing was the big bear hug or the backbreaker. And I don't know if he'd have went anywhere. But in a match with Kowalski, Kowalski had a move that he'd come off the top rope and stomp on the guy and then pin him or whatever it was. And in one of their matches, Kowalski came off and his boot hit the side of, you know, they never intentionally hit him or actually
put
the stomp on him, really. But his boot came down and hit Yukon's ear, and it actually broke, took the bottom of his ear off. And this is a true story. You can look this up, and there's pictures of this. Yukon's earpiece, or part of his ear, was laying in the ring, and it's bleeding. And the referee had picked up the ear, and they took Yukon to the hospital. And his ear couldn't be reattached. So if you look at pictures of Yukon Eric years after, he's got his ear is missing. Well, what they did from this, it was so beautiful because without fans knowing it, Kowalski had actually went up to the hospital when Yukon was there. And he went up to see his friend and there was apologies and the whole thing. But the newspapers picked it up and Kowalski was laughing that I went up there. I was surprised he was still alive. And I'm sorry he's not, I didn't finish him off. Well, for the rest of their careers. Now, unfortunately, Yukon died sadly by his own hand. And that's a whole nother story. But Yukon Eric passed away in 63. But from 53 to 63, the matches between Kowalski and Eric, if you had them on your card, you had a sellout crowd.
Yeah.
And he became Killer Kowalski because he tried to kill a man. And when he's in the ring, he tries to kill his opponent. Oh, my God. Yeah. But that was an accidental thing that created one of the honest-to-God monumental main events. And outside the ring, they were buddies.
All right. Well, George, I want to thank you for coming on today. One last note.
Fun. Always fun.
I will. One last note. If you don't know already, folks, a friend of ours is revamping the promotion WWA, and Mr. George Shire is the president of the WWA. He is part of the world's most dangerous wrestling promotion. So that makes him the world's most dangerous wrestling president.
Oh, boy.
Well, so, yes, Brad, congratulations.
Brad Drake approached me, yeah, and he offered me the Stanley Blackburn position.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to see that WWA wrestling is in tone, and we don't have to level any fines and suspensions, but if we do, we will. How's that sound?
That sounds good. The rule of law, right?
Right.
Well, George, thank you again for coming on today, discussing this. I've learned a lot. I know the fans that are watching this or listening to this have learned something as well. Always good to have you on here. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I always enjoy it, Brian. And I just encourage folks, I appreciate when you let me share the stories, because they come from my heart. This is what I live for every day.
Yeah.
I'm going to push my book. It's still out there, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. It's on Amazon.
Yep.
I invite people to go to my George Shires Wrestling Time Machine on Facebook.
Yes.
And if you like old school, we're not talking today's wrestling.
Right.
We're talking anything pre-90.
Yeah.
Or back 90.
Yeah.
Join the group. Yeah. And lots of clippings, lots of stories, lots of programs, lots of magazines, lots of nostalgia.
It is. It's a great page. I'm a member. I'll have all that in the description. When I have George on here, I always have his books. He's not just got the Golden Age, he's got the record books of the AWA, 60s, 70 to 74, 75 to 79, and his Golden Age of Wrestling, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling, from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. Get those books. They're great. They're great. They're great historical. I mean, I use them all the time. I look up stuff when I'm intrigued. And they're so accurate, of course, because George does not do anything half-heartedly. He puts it all in. And I'm not just saying that because he's on here. He is a good friend of mine, but he really does 100% effort. And guys like you are far in between, my friend, and I really thank you, and I know the fans do too, for your knowledge and expertise. So
I'd like to just throw out a plug too. I know it's a month away at this point. But if there's anyone in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Twin Cities, surrounding suburbs area, April 2nd, it's a Tuesday, I am going to be doing one of my regular wrestling talks at the Washington County Heritage Center. It's right off of Highway 36 in Stillwater and Greeley Avenue. It's very easy to find. It's right close to St. Paul. 6:30 in the evening, and it's free. You can't beat that. It's free to attend.
So if
you're in the local area or you're coming through, come on and talk, or come on back and listen. Got some fun stuff planned that night.
I know you do. All right, one more time. George Shire, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
If you're watching, thank you. If you're listening, thank you. And if you haven't subscribed, please do so. And we will talk to you soon.
Hey, this is Total Package, Lex Luger, and you're listening to the VOC Nation. Don't miss out.
VOC Nation's own Stro Maestro suffered a major medical and financial catastrophe this year. From the VOC Nation family, to all of you, please continue to pray for Stro Maestro for his continued recovery. You can also donate to his cause, paypal.me/PapaStro. The worldwide leader in entertainment. This is the VOC Nation Radio Network.
Check out In the Room
every Tuesday night at 9. Listen in.
Pro Wrestling Illustrated's Brady Hicks, former WCW star Stro Maestro, Cassie Fist, Matt Grimm.
And you and Ray are there too, right, Ray?
We sure are, and we've got great guests like Lex Luger, AJ Styles, Taku, and more. It's a heck of a party. Plus,
I didn't get thrown off buildings.
And then
I didn't get pregnant either.
Sometimes I think it gets so ridiculous.
We were getting into like snuff film territory there.
In the Room.
9 p.m. Eastern on VOC Nation.
Yo, this is Jerry Steins of the Nasty Boys. Yeah, Brian Knobs here. You getting ready to get nasty? Well, listen to the VOC Nation, baby.
VOC Nation is one of the longest-running wrestling podcast networks. Having started way back in 2010, VOC Nation provides daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with their hosts and guests via phone calls, emails, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include former backstage interviewer from both AWA and WWE, Ken Resnick, former WCW performer The Maestro, former Impact performer Wes Crisco, Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor Brady Hicks, and former Philadelphia radio personality Bruce Works. Archive-free content includes past interviews with huge names like Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, Kurt Angle, Jimmy Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Sting, Mick Foley, Joey Styles, Howard Finkel, and so many more. Listen live at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all the podcasts by searching VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. And be sure to follow these guys on Twitter at VOC Nation.
Bill Apter has been in the pro wrestling business for over 50 years.
Hey, Tony here with Arn Anderson. Arn, first of all, your height and weight.
6'1", 255.
And now subscribers to VOC Nation Premium get exclusive access to Bill Apter's archived audio footage.
And where's your hometown?
Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, and give us something about your back. First of all, your relationship to Ole Anderson.
Ole is my...
Subscription to VOC Nation Premium starts at just $3 a month and includes commercial-free audio and video versions of our top podcasts.
Okay, we're speaking here with the manager of the World Heavyweight Tag Team Champions, Tarzan Tyler and Luke Graham, and he's sort of glowing tonight about a new prospect we haven't heard of yet.
And for just $9 a month, Apter's archives are all yours.
Would you tell us who this new prospect
is?
Well,
I'll tell you, Bill, I've searched the world, and I finally found the true world champion. I finally found...
What's your opinion of Ivan Koloff winning the title from Bruno Sammartino?
Well, I think, I don't know what to say, but I want to say one thing. Bruno was a hell of a champion. You know?
Here are exclusive interviews with the greatest performers of all time.
This is Bill Apter, and once again, we're speaking here with Bruno Sammartino. Bruno, first of all, how did you and Bruiser lose that title to the Valiants?
Well, actually, it was a very unusual loss, if you want to call it a loss.
Did he didn't have anything to do?
Well, yes, but the whole thing is this, that the rules, as I always understood them, was that the title could only be lost by pin or submission, which is the same rules as my title, the World Wrestling Federation. That night, it was...
To sign up, it's very simple. Head to premium.vocnation.com or go to patreon.com/vocnation. VOC Nation takes you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history.
Each and every Thursday night, check it out. WCW star Stro Maestro takes you on a journey. It's WCW Retro. Talking old school match of the week, talking dream matches, taking your calls and looking back on an incredible career of acting, entertaining, and wrestling. Check it out, vocnation.com, WCW Retro. Be sure to call in Thursday nights, 9 Eastern, on the VOC Nation Radio Network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.